session number 19666, Reel 4.
He Sam Shepherdson, Reel 4.
He tried to seduce me, but I did not succumb. One interesting experience I had as the war drew to its conclusion...
Sorry, was that RSM white or black?
White. The black RSM was a real Scottish mission-trained Puritan, and all the better for that, in my humble opinion. As the war drew to its conclusion, we were really trained right up to going back into action again. And the night after the bomb was dropped, I suppose that was the first one, I'm not sure, we were in Ranchi in Bihar, and we had semi-permanent encampments there, and I was orderly officer that night in the orderly room of the 13th NYKAR, and we'd all just gone to sleep, myself and the black orderly room staff, and hell of a lot of drumming all along the 11th East African Division front. Bang, 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 bang. And our colonel, Colonel Williams, who alas is now dead, came bursting in and said, "Get me something to stand on and a megaphone and fall in the battalion." And we fell them in, and he got in on the chair with his megaphone, and he said, "The war is over. We have dropped a big bomb on the Japanese, and we have said to them, if you do not surrender, you will receive another bomb. Mudzilandira bomuina." Well, two reactions to that. As soon as it was over, I'm no hero, as you know from this poem I've just read, but we were so trained up to go back, at least I was, that I felt bitterly disappointed that I wasn't going back. I'm not embroidering that, that's the actual feeling. The African soldiers felt, when he said that, that they were going back home immediately. And of course they weren't. They were right on the tail end of the demobilisation list. Whites first, Browns, Indians second, Blacks third. Hence the feeling, as I was told by our former company sergeant major in Malawi some years ago, on the boats when they went back. I would dearly love to know what effect that made upon the returned soldiers. When I flew out on Class B release, I left a large sum of money, about £26 or £30, which was a lot of money in those days, with one of the Europeans for my orderly, so that when he got back to Nyasaland, he could buy a bicycle. Because every African who wanted to set up in what he called an Chitiya business, wanted either a bicycle or a sewing machine. And all I can say is I hope he got back all right, and he got his £30, and he got his bicycle. The general feeling of the Malawi soldiers, and possibly also the East African soldiers, as I say, came out in some of their songs. There's one song, I don't remember much of it, but it went, "Dinayenda, Pazikola Buluma, Ajapani Kunditawa, Chifuka Cha African. I am going to the country of Burma. The Japanese are fleeing because of the African." Well, I don't think the Africans made them flee all that much, but they kept the retreat going. And there were a number of individual heroic actions. But what many of our African soldiers did out there, in the way of what you call pioneering tasks, are absolutely fantastic. When we were just inside Burma, which as you know is full of teak trees, and the monsoon was on the go, we did some pioneering tasks. We put logs across the road, corduroy the road is the military term for it, to try and bring the guns forward. And I've seen an African, I think of him in particular, a little stocky fellow called Master Malata, with his panga, his machete, the universal instrument of all the East African soldiers, cutting down 4 or 5 6-inch to a foot thick wet teak trees in a day. that takes some doing. And then they were pulled down by the elephants and put on the road. I think my inspiration has more or less come to a conclusion.
I was interested in that snatch you just sang then, because of they appeared to use the word African.
Yes.
Were they conscious of being Africans?
Oh, yes. Well, don't forget, they might not have been when they were in their villages, but when they joined the King's African Rifles, then that's the word African comes to them. Certainly, I think many of them must have got out of the war, and particularly those who went right to the extremity, Burma. Not only the 11th East African Division, but there were various groups of scouts and others. They must have got a sense of elementary Pan-Africanism, because there were Belgian Congo troops there, there were one or two French Africans. There were even some Portuguese African soldiers, not in Burma, but around the Goa area in India. There were the 81st and 82nd West African Divisions, Gold Coast, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, and so on and so on. And now, if you will excuse me, as I said to you earlier, Difunuku Kodza.
So you've almost suggested there that it was the KR itself which implanted an idea of African consciousness.
Not as part of official policy, but if you get different tribes in a territorial battalion, that does do something to create consciousness of coming from a particular territory. And if you get Africans from different territories, Kenya, Uganda, Tanganyika, a few perhaps from Zanzibar, in a division, even in a holding camp together, they may not speak each other's languages at first, but they soon pick them up because they are as similar as Portuguese and Spanish. It's not all that similar, but similar enough. And it does produce a rudimentary political feeling. Now, with the Kenya Askari, one of the Mau Mau leaders, I don't know whether he's still alive, was called, his name, second name was Itote, but he was known as General China. And he wrote a book which was published commercially in Nairobi, and it said in it, "I got my political ideas in the trenches before Kalewa." That was the town on the Chinwin which had to be captured before they could build the Bailey Bridge across it. Now, I have some scepticism for that, but the fact that he felt that he could say it is an indication of a growing type of political consciousness. Also, on the less pleasant side of political consciousness, many Askari, at least in my experience, who were in India, strengthened, as I said earlier, their distrust for Indians, whom they had probably known as not very pleasant people, running, exploiting shops, dukas in their own country. This is not universally true, but there was that feeling. And I can remember when we were back in Dimapur, before we went to Ranchi in Bihar, the East Africa or Southeast Asia Command started two magazines, one in Swahili for Swahili speakers called Heshima, Honor, an equivalent for Nyanja speakers called Ulemu. And both of these magazines had a correspondence column which literate Africans could use for writing letters in. And we had a storekeeper who must have been a Muslim, the name of Corporal Salim. And he wrote a letter to Ulemu, and they published it, and the letter was complaining about the high prices and generally low wages that Indians, Asians, in Malawi employed. And I thought, struck me as rather significant, that the only thing he could think about was not training to go back into action or getting a bit of leave at Mariani or something like that, but wondering when they got back if the Indians were still going to run the lower grades of business and the Africans wouldn't get a look in. Because what was done towards the end of the war with African soldiers, certainly Eastern Central African soldiers, all sorts of pamphlets came out, as I presume they did in the British Army, about what sort of job would you like after the war. And almost all the Africans I knew said, and Chito means work, yeah, business, for business, Brian. It meant small shopkeeping or something of that sort. And it's rather unpleasant to reflect that a fair number of Niassa soldiers that I met, and some who weren't Niassas, felt very bitterly about Indians. And I can give one example of this, which is illustrative of the fact that there was, and there still is, a colour bar amongst coloureds. We had an orderly room sergeant, a fairly well-educated man. He wasn't from Nyasaland, I think he was from Kenya. Sergeant John Leo, L-E-O, which incidentally is a Swahili word for today. And John Leo was a very nice man. And when we were in Bihar, he went into the local town Ranchi and he went into an Indian shop to get his hair cut. And the Indian hairdresser refused to cut his hair. And he said, "You are a jungly walla. I don't cut the hairs of jungly wallas." And John Leo then proceeded to tear the shop apart. And was court-martialed and reduced to the ranks.
What about the loyalty and motivation of the Askari?
I think most of the Askari were very loyal, remarkably loyal, considering...
To whom or to what?
They were loyal primarily, of course, to their officers. And if they didn't like the officers... And they weren't. But they were ultimately quite loyal to the king, who was a remote figure. Many of them had joined in response to local publicity about fighting the Germans, because they were people who looked down on black people. But the primary loyalty was to the officer. And I hope I'm not telling too many unpleasant experiences this morning. And again, I'm not going to mention any names. But when we were out of action, and we ultimately back in Ranchi training to go back, we had quite a lot of reinforcements posted to us. And we had one white officer posted to us. I didn't know him personally, but he came from not all that far from here. He spoke extremely good Nyanja, and he was second in command of the company, and I was at that time lieutenant. But for some reason, he was extremely contemptuous of Africans. And one day, one of our African soldiers came to me, Lance Corporal Stanley Sanudi, a real little chap. And he said, Bwana Captain, so-and-so, not. He says nasty things to us. He also complained about a sergeant, and this was a white sergeant from Northern Rhodesia. And the complaints poured out. So I did a thing which I was very hesitant to do. I went to see the commanding officer. I requested an interview, and I said, "I'm bringing this before you, sir, and perhaps I shouldn't bring it, but I do want you to know that there are African grievances against Captain so-and-so." I said, "And I have a feeling that if he remains in this company, there's going to be trouble." And the CO, and I'd been with the battalion a long time by then, I'd been in action with them and this other chap hadn't. The CO took him out of the company and put him in a neutral position in the battalion.
That chap, you mentioned the Askari who complained to you about the wage differential
between
blacks and whites. Was he typical, do you think, in his feelings?
Yes, I think he probably was. There were stories that in India, particularly in Ranchi and Bihar, when Africans who were near an Indian town were allowed to go there. And some of them met black American GIs. And the black American GIs wouldn't know much African language, if any, and the Africans wouldn't know much English, but somehow they managed to communicate. And the black American GIs would probably give them a few drinks. And they would see how well off the black American GIs were in comparison with them, and indeed with us to some extent. So there were various ways in which this kind of discontent was fed. What interests me, though, about African soldiers abroad, not so much political or economic discontent, but what effect the sudden widening of the horizons were. Because to go on a ship was an amazing experience. To go in an aeroplane was an even more amazing experience. When they flew us out of Burma, I with my platoon, that's about 30-odd Africans, we went in a Dakota, which was used for airdropping, pushing out parachutes or free drops. And they'd never been in a plane before. I'd had three flights before then, two over Peterborough and one when I flew from backward battalion to a forward battalion in Burma. And they accepted, as a matter of fact, that if I'd go in, they'd go in. And I had a very grim experience because they went in first. And the Dakota isn't much wider than this room. And I sat over there. And there was the door over there. And the two American pilots who were flying it left the door open. Because they were only flying at about 1,000 feet or less at times. And I must admit, it scared me stiff. I was right next to that open door. Only, I don't know, 40, 50 feet away from it, if it suddenly lurched, which of course it wouldn't because the flying conditions were so good. I can remember sweating all over, but I had to keep a stiff upper lip so that they didn't all panic. But what was the effect of this experience of ships? And some of them went on. They went from Mombasa to Ceylon, one ship from Ceylon to Chittagong, and another from Chittagong up to Dozari, up the Brahmaputra, on another. And then on a ship on the way back. And they probably had two aeroplane flights. And some of them, for the first time in their lives, went on trains. What was the general effect of widening horizons? We saw what the effect of widening horizons were on British soldiers. They voted the Labour government in, didn't they, in a big way.
Whilst you were with the 13th KAR, what was your job specifically?
I was an infantry officer, straightforward platoon commander.
Do you remember the name of the platoon and the company?
Now, I'm a bit vague on this. I think I was most of the time with D Company. And we had three platoons. And I cannot for the life of me remember whether I was number one, number two, or number three platoon. But I'm pretty sure I was with D Company most of the time.
And what rank did you have?
I finished as captain. But when we were in Burma, I was lieutenant all the time.
In your platoon, would all the men be of one tribe or mixed?
Mixed. Mixed. Quite definitely. Great many Yao, Y-A-O. Some of them were very light-skinned. They got a considerable Arab mixture. They had often been agents in the slave trade, the Arab slave trade, from the interior to the coast. We had a large number of Nyanja, as they called themselves, who came from the lake region. We had a large number of Ngoni. They were descendants of Zulu invaders in Nyasaland, Malawi. We had quite a lot of Nguru, who prefer now to call themselves Lomwe, who came from Portuguese East Africa to escape from Portuguese colonialism into Nyasaland. And then we had all sorts of minor tribes. I remember with great affection a man who had a moustache, a very few Askari had moustaches, called John Makua. And the Makua are a tribe who span the Rovuma River, which is the border between Tanzania now and Mozambique as it is today. I also had quite a lot of experience of other tribes from Swahili battalions, because I had a certain amount of intercourse with Swahili battalions. Not, I may say, having spoken earlier, sexual intercourse, social, educational intercourse, administrative intercourse. I met lots of them. But Nyasaland, anyway, was very much of a multi-tribal country. And I had experience of many tribes, although the only language I learnt basis of was the Nyanja language. But I picked up all sorts of words in other languages.
Was there any sense in which human individuality was submerged in tribal characteristics?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the more you get to know a person, and I got to know my chaps fairly well, you see their individual characteristics. But you could also tell, say, an Ngoni were a pretty fierce lot. I saw some of their dances, they're still pretty fierce when we were out of action. But if you don't know the people, then you create tribal stereotypes, which was quite common.
We sometimes hear that British colonialists practice divide and rule. Was there anything of that in the KR from what you saw?
Not in the Nyasa battalions that I saw. Not at all. You heard it said that this existed in the Indian battalions, particularly after the Indian Mutiny of 1857. But I didn't see any of it in the KR at all.
Any other songs you can sing? On the
well, the many of these songs are sung to British Army tunes. The most famous one, and curiously enough, this was sung in a movie, which you may have seen, called Where No Vultures Fly. And it was actually sung by a West African actor who was in charge of a group of East African police. Tufungi safari, tufungi opesi, tufungi safari, tufungi opesi, amri yanane, amri yabana kapteni, amri yakea, on and on. Now that's a European tune. And there were rather pathetic songs to European tunes, such as Kingi Georgi, Kingi Georgi, Kingi Georgi, Mtukufu, Kilasiku, Tutamonga, Mungu Wai, Yekiku. But the really moving ones, ones in strict vernacular, and most of those songs were originally written by officers in the original KR. Most moving songs were the traditional African songs. Ajumbe tilina, ajumbe akana kulemera. That's a song about a particular type of semi-Arab chief. And there were songs that are brought into the KR, and there were Swahili equivalents, from Africans who'd been porters in the pre-mechanized transport era of colonialism. And many others, and some of them, of course, were political songs which were used under military conditions.
Political?
Yes, things of, political in the sense that Ziko Lani Asalande Dilinau Chisoni. I can't sing it in the proper way. I am taking pity on the land of Nyasaland. Dilinau Chisoni, my ome, and Tawi Azungu. Oh, dear me, the time of the Europeans. That's what I mean in that sense.
What, regretting the time of the Europeans?
Yes, regretting it.
Condemning the...
Not condemning it, regretting it. They wouldn't condemn it, because they've got enough wit to know that Europeans brought not only literacy, and some would appreciate the bringing of Christianity, more than most people realise nowadays. They brought bicycles, they brought motor cars, they brought shops, they brought money, etc., etc., and above all, they brought medicine, Mankwala. That's why David Livingstone was successful in Nyasaland above all others. And it was general regret.
Regretting the Europeans had gone?
had come and had changed the whole social setup. But much of these songs I did not understand because they sang in not a secret patois, but in a patois which wasn't taught in the general language teaching books, full of slang.
I don't quite understand this. I mean, were they happy the Europeans had come or sorry the Europeans had come?
Well, that song is being sorry that the Europeans have come.
And yet you say they brought beneficial things.
Yes, I say they were not. My impression of Nyasa's at that time was they had a split feeling on Europeans. They were sorry that the Europeans had come because there were unpleasant practices brought with them. There was the introduction of colour bars from South Africa and southern and northern Rhodesia. There were often difficult conditions on the estates. But on the other hand, many of them had led perfectly reasonable, lowly paid lives on the estates. And although they were sorry to see Europeans in their country, they, a point I was trying to make, had sufficient sense, indeed more than sufficient sense, to realise that many of the things that the Europeans brought were eminently desirable, such as medicine, mankwala. I remember one of our askari who wasn't incidentally a Nyasa, he was a Luo from western Kenya. Jefferson Mungau, his name was. He came one day with a copy of a paper he got through the post, the Bantu Mirror, it was called, from South Africa. And he handed me this paper and he said, Bwana, Nanga Aspro. Well, you recognise the word Aspro for the commercial brand of aspirin. Nanga means what? What's Aspro like? And he showed this advertisement in one of the African languages. And he got a bad headache. He said, is it good enough mankwala? Well, I hadn't got any aspirin, but I got some aspirin, so I gave him a few aspirins. They recognised that kind of thing. You hear a great deal about folk medicine, but folk medicine in every society, in every colour, has its limitations, doesn't it? And they had enough sense to realise that.
How do you feel now about having served with Central Africans?
Well, from my point of view, I read that poem out, Sailor. Many say when they get back, I'm glad I went, I wouldn't have stayed at home. And obviously, if one's life is threatened, as it was in Burma, you can't say that with too much relish. But looking back on that experience, it is an unforgettable experience. And since I became a university teacher, and I began to dig into the history of Malawi and of other parts of Africa, I've written a number of things about it, including one large book called Independent African, which deals with a native rising in Nyasaland during the First World War, which was partly a protest against the employment of Africans in the First World War. And I've edited a field notebook of David Livingstone when he explored the Rovuma, and I've written a great many articles on Africa. So it helped me professionally. But it did show me another side of the world which I had no idea existed.
Could I ask you about something post-war? Because you had an experience in Yugoslavia building a railroad.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you get that job?
Well, I was in my first long vacation from the university when I went back to St. John's College, Cambridge. And I'd knocked around a good deal during the war. And I wanted something to do during the long vacations in addition to